to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours, episode 153 for March 2nd, 2021. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflaw.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we have made it through the rift. No, the drift.
I see what you did there.
And
very nice.
Here we are. We are starting our next book. Our book for the month of March is Wrassle by Jeff Smith. And Chip, you are the one who brought this book to us. So tell us all about this book.
All right. So if you have a young person in school right now, you've probably been to some kind of book fair at some point, well, at least before the pandemic, and you've seen a book called Bone. So Bone is a comic book that started back in the late 80s during the black and white boom. It went on for a long, long time. Then Scholastic got involved and basically packaged them all together. And if you're lucky enough to have a great big Bone book, I mean, it's probably is bigger than a brick. And a lot of young people have enjoyed reading it. When it eventually comes out into a movie, it should be a big event. I mean, and maybe the type of character, maybe like, maybe Mickey Mouse could be a character. Now, after Jeff Smith completed that story, he was looking for something to write on. And certainly he picked a more mature theme. This is a book that's called Wrassle. It is a noir. There is conspiracy involved. There's Native American imagery. There is some kind of plot to steal stuff. And then there's alternate reality. So certainly all brought together in this one story that we're exploring right now.
And it was published in black and white originally, but most of us are reading the color version, right?
Yes.
And so this is a comic book, a graphic novel, and so a lot of the storytelling here is not narrative. It is told in these pictures in a lot of pages.
You certainly are seeing it. In fact, that's one of the skills that Jeff really has mastered. Many people confuse, they get wrapped up in putting too much narrative into a visual story, or they don't put any narrative in it, and it's sometimes very hard to figure out exactly what's going on with a less skilled storyteller. Jeff Smith certainly has mastered this craft, and this is a skilled story.
Visual storytelling. That is a great way to put it, Chip. This was originally published in February of 2008, the very first comic book came out for this series, Wrassle. Then the next issue came out in June of 2008. And then the third one in October of 2008. I can't put my mind back to 2008 and think that I would read one third of the story that we read today and then wait that long between February and June to get the next piece.
Yeah, that seems to be a difficult thing to do. I know what Jeff did was he packaged these together. So the first three issues would come out, and then he would package those together in a single book and send those out. There was oversized books. There were regular-sized books. He certainly was playing a lot with different type of publications. He is self-publishing this book. That is something also very unique, is that he basically is determining how he presents this material and controlling it.
But do you guys think that the way that we read has changed in the past 13 years since this as well? I mean, I feel like Netflix has really changed the way that we access content. And so I'm totally guilty of, I never start watching a series until there's at least one season available. And so, oh, something is coming out like next Tuesday. Oh, great. Tell me when there's 12 of them, then I'll start watching. And so I think that we have sort of trained ourselves to read things in a way that I think 12 or 13 years ago, I would have had the patience, Steve, and you would have too. We've changed as readers and consumers of popular culture.
And I think Netflix is absolutely the culprit here. I think that we have had this discussion. Hulu puts out a weekly program on their streaming service.
Cough, cough, WandaVision.
Okay. All right. There are still certain programs that if I don't watch them on the moment that they come out, I can't communicate with other humans. Because, yes, WandaVision is a show that because it exists on a weekly basis, I cannot use the internet until I've seen that program because I'm so allergic to spoilers. Some of the words that Jeff Smith uses here are very poignant, and it opens with a quote from Nikola Tesla.
Oh, that's right. He says, throughout space, there is energy. Is this energy static or kinetic? If static, our hopes are in vain. If kinetic, and this is what we know it is for certain, then it is a mere question of time when men will succeed in attaching the machinery to the very wheelwork of nature. That encapsulates what we know about Tesla, the mysterious part of Tesla. Tesla was convinced that energy was something to be tapped into. It didn't need to be produced. It was just part of what makes reality reality. And that one day we would just tap into it and the whole world would have energy.
I'm really fascinated by that notion, that image of men, and I notice this is gendered, but men attaching their machinery to the wheelwork of nature. And I'm actually currently reading with my students an Octavia Butler book in which we meet an alien species whose technology is fully organic with zero mechanical portions. And so this notion of like the mechanization, or we might even think over mechanization of our interactions with nature, actually, I think that produces a large challenge to our stewardship of the earth. And so I've been thinking a lot about the existential climate crisis that we face, as I'm sure you all have. And this notion is really tapping into something, like this notion that what would count as success is fully attaching our machinery to nature. Whew, scary thought in a lot of ways.
Oh, it's fascinating, though. But think about if you are a third world country and immediately you could wake up and you could have all the energy you needed. That means you have the lights to be able to have your time at night. Your time could be redefined.
And you can totally buy into the meta narrative of human progress equals mechanization and mechanical technology, or you could question that narrative.
But this book is not all about Tesla. That's not what we're talking about today. This is the idea here of finding a way to tap into not only free energy, but into the universe itself. We have here chapter one. So we have act one, which is the first three books, called The Drifter. And part one is called The Drift. I love this play on words, where we have the word drifter, and we understand that word as somebody who goes from place to place. That's a drifter. But here we are presented with a character who has the ability to go from place to place using this thing called the drift to travel between different universes.
And that's the other part that this book is going to explore. It's the idea of alternate realities or alternate universes. Parallel universes is probably a better way of describing it.
One of my favorite conversations is parallel universes. The idea that every decision that every human has ever made, also that same human makes the opposite decision in an opposite universe and follows all the consequences of that decision.
And didn't we just discuss a little bit of this in our last book, Recursion?
Yes, we did, where one of the characters said that means that there is no choice. And we said, no, there's choice. You make a choice. And then the author in that book said, no, if I chose the opposite because some other me in some other universe somewhere chose one way, I get no choice whatsoever. It's fascinating, this idea of multi-universe. Are you familiar with the TV show Sliders?
I am not. That's called television, Steve.
I know, it's a television show. Pam, did you ever watch Sliders?
I did not. Nope.
Oh, boy. We have another podcast to start, you and I, then, where you have to rewatch Sliders. That story is early 90s Fox show wherein a young boy, a young genius, discovers a wormhole to go to alternate universes and then spends the rest of the series lost amongst all of the infinity of universes that are out there trying to find his way back to his prime universe.
It sounds like that really taps into a lot of these questions about like what counts as a do-over. So like, how do you make choices and decisions, and how would you make them differently if you had another opportunity?
Something that we've talked about in the last two books, and here we are once again faced with that same question: is there fate or is there choice?
In fact, we even have a scene that's directly related to it. After he drifts, comes back, he thinks it's his reality, goes to a bar, and then there was something that was off. He just gets, something gets noted that it's off. And what's interesting is that his way of coping with that is all the alcohol. Line them up. What did he have? He had
one bourbon, one scotch, one beer. No, that's a different song.
No, he had a Grey Goose. He had a beer, and he had a shot of something. I can't remember what it was. Then he has to line him up again because, you know, he's a hard drinker. This is a noir part, right?
Right. This is definitely a noir writing. Yes, he is a hard drinker. Yes, he has an alcohol problem. Yes, everybody recognizes his alcohol problem, but he sees it as his way to cope with whatever stress that we're going to get into. We haven't gotten really into the narrative of the past of this character, but his present is full of stress.
And can I ask you guys a question? In terms of when we're first introduced to Rassel, I just wanted to think about the visuals a little bit. How old do you think he is? I really struggled to figure that out because it felt like, in a sense, he had this very like angry little boy facial expression in these first few scenes. But he also has this very muscular grown-up body with the tattoo of Maya. And I just couldn't decide how old he was. I found very funny because usually with a visual, that's a cue you can easily pick up on.
That may be, you know, I'm going to not to beat up Jeff Smith a little bit. I think that's a little bit of his fault because we know that he is a scientist. Later on, we were introduced to the part where he's working in the science lab where they're developing this. So let's just say that he's in his 20s or whatever like that. This guy may be in his late 30s, 40s. What do you think he is? So he has to be somewhere around there. I don't think he's 30.
And I feel like the image is a little incongruous with that, because as I was reading along, he kept feeling like, wait, he has to be older than I initially thought, just as you're saying there, Chip. And I'm kind of curious about what the impact of that is, especially in those first scenes when it looks like he's just sort of waking up.
Because when we're introduced to this character, his torso is so small. From shoulder to hip, he looks like a very small person. And the idea of small sometimes equates to young. When we see him in the flashback, where we're seeing him as a scientist creating this mechanism to tap into the multiverse, he actually looks a lot older here. And I think it's because we don't see his ratio from shoulder to hip. And that equation of size to age does make it very incongruous is a great word. I love that word. I don't know. I don't know what we're supposed to think for his age. He must be an adult. He's acting like an adult. He's got adult situations.
Late 30s or 40s, but he certainly doesn't look that way.
He's got a boyish face. Yeah. I agree. And the haircut. The haircut is very, very teenager.
Oh, and compare the haircut. Well, I think it's meant to be unkept. Yeah, as a person who is certainly, when he was working in the lab, you know, he had a much more conservative haircut and certainly much more reserved. And then, you know, whatever ended up happening to get him on this, you know, life of thievery certainly has made him, a little wilder as far as his look.
So let's talk about this life of thievery that you brought up. We see in the first book that he is using this mechanism to travel to an alternate reality and to steal a Picasso painting. And he steals that painting and leaves his calling card in spray paint, the letters R-A-S-L, which is the title of the book and apparently is the name that he goes by, our protagonist here.
And I pronounce it as Razzle. As we were kind of preparing for the show, I was trying to think, does this count for something? Is this code for something? The symbol RA is radium. That is an unnatural element, certainly of energy. Mm-hmm. And then I also looked up in Ra is the sun god, Egyptian sun god. There's a falcon imagery that is part of this. This is Ra is believed to rule all parts of the created world, the sky, the earth, and the underworld. He is the god of the sun, order, kings, and the sky. Ra is portrayed as a falcon and shares characteristics of the sky god Horus. So, you know, is there something that we should be reading into this name? I don't know.
The first time we see the mechanism, we see that it does have bird-like qualities. This is our first story of, we're going to go ahead and call it time travel, although it's multiple universe travel. But this is our first time in the book club that we've had an actual machine that does the travel instead of just some magical force that brings us to and fro. And he's got a face shield that certainly is reminiscent of ancient American folklore here.
Well, I use Native American, and okay. Some people may say, you know, Mayan or Aztec. It's one of those, but it certainly has this look, and it almost looks like the Mayan calendar or the Aztec calendar.
Yeah, it does. It is reminiscent of that calendar. Interesting.
As we're kind of looking over the landscape of our original place where we're introduced to, it is of the desert. I mean, it certainly could be. I don't know if they give us where we are. It could be New Mexico. It could be Arizona. It certainly has this feeling that we are at far west.
We're introduced as well to our antagonist so far, which is this interesting character. Very alien-drawn sort of character here.
And I'm interested, Chip, that you mentioned the falcon, because when I first saw this very unusual looking character who kind of has this sort of lizard-like face, but also sort of this odd, like, simian quality, but dressed like a hard-boiled detective, you know, wearing a fedora, a trench coat, the guns out, reminds me of Sam Spade from the Maltese Falcon. And of course, the Maltese Falcon is this symbol of the unknowable. And the falcon, of course, gets picked up in Yeats' poem, The Second Coming, where the falcon cannot hear the falconer, which speaks to this 20th century anxiety about technology run amok. And so what if our technology gets away from us? What if we no longer have control over what we have created or think that we are able to manage and to use for our own purposes? And so that theme of technology has all this potential, but does it also have some darkness and danger? Felt very, very multi-layered in the way that this novel unfolds.
Because we find that this antagonist has a chip implanted in his wrist. So there's some technology here that is beyond the technology that our protagonist has available to him to switch between universes.
I was going to say, the switch between universes is to take that shield and the airplane machine. I don't know. This machinery he wraps on his body certainly is very different than what we think this lizard-looking guy who is chasing him down looks like.
This notion of miniaturization, right? This notion of like a chip versus this gigantic apparatus.
Sure.
Chip is pretty big, though. I know that we've never been in the room together, Pam, but Chip is pretty large.
Well, yeah, one of us is. All right, so What we need to do is let's talk a little bit about some of the things that define our character. He certainly has this big tattoo saying Maya here. Sounds like that may be his girlfriend or something that passed away in his timeline, but lives.
Yeah. We get to that in book three. Book three is titled Maya, and we get to meet her, or an alternative her, maybe.
A version of her.
Uh-huh. And yes, the very prominent tattoo in the first book, where we're trying desperately to understand the world that we're in the beginning of this story. And we get these little clues that Jeff Smith has left for us. That word Maya. And then by book three, we get to see who Maya was.
Yeah. And let's talk a little bit also about how we know it's an alternative reality. But he goes over to the jukebox to play some music. And what does he say?
He goes to try to play Bob Dylan and finds Bob Dylan's album, but it doesn't have Bob Dylan's name on it. Or does it? Bob Dylan, he used the stage name Bob Dylan, but he was born Robert Zimmerman. And in this alternative reality, in this book, that is the name that we find on the album. Do you know why he called himself Bob Dylan, Pam?
I didn't until I read your notes. I won't pretend that I did. I did not.
I'd like to call a friend.
My Nobel laureate poet.
He adopted the name Dylan after discovering the works of the Welsh poet Dylan Thomas, and he enjoyed Dylan Thomas's work so much that he adopted the name. And that's, ladies and gentlemen, how we got Bob Dylan in this universe.
Well, you know, what is fascinating about it is that he wasn't Nobel Prize winner at that point. He was Bob Dylan the singer, or mm-hmm. Bob Dylan the poet. And so isn't it interesting... Well, reading this back, knowing what happened to Bob Dylan or what he got to experience. How lovely
apparently,
is that?
Apparently, Bob Dylan and I have something in common because I also very much enjoy the works of Dylan Thomas. Certainly, The Portrait of the Artist as a Young Dog is wonderfully wry and poignant. But I think Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night is the famous poem that might most easily mesh with this novel, this idea of like, what are the different processes that you can use to think about death, think about your own death, the death of your loved ones. Very good.
So Steve and I once again put a check mark on why Pam is here.
Uh-huh.
She's going to make us literate whether we like it or not.
And Nikola Tesla was in the Victorian era, of course. And I already knew that about you with Dylan Thomas, Pam. That's why I put that in the show notes, by the way.
All right. So once our hero experiences this alternate universe changing, it's certainly a very physically traumatic type of experience for him. He doesn't feel particularly well. He self-medicates with alcohol, and he also uses meditation and some other mechanisms to calm him down, put him into the right space to be able to function.
Yeah, I noted that. He said out loud, a couple hours of meditation might be enough to get me home. It seems to me that the user of this machine has to be mindful of the place and time that he wants to travel to in order to arrive safely. Like, there's a hazard to just going out into the universe. You can't travel at light speed without plotting a course. You'll wind up in an asteroid, kid. Star Wars. So? That's Star Wars.
Always a Star Wars.
That's Star Wars.
Well, this is how we learn things, Steve.
It's not like dusting crops, kid. I find it interesting that he ties mindfulness into this jumping through this universe with this machine.
Well, you're arriving someplace. And I think that may be what's happening, is you've got to ground yourself when you get there. But it looks like it's physically impacting you too. So, I mean, there's, so your mind is trying to ground itself. It's physically exerting yourself to move to this position. So I think, you know, it also creates the vulnerability. You're in a point of weakness once you use it, or once you return back to where you're going. So I think it's a plot device also.
I love trying to figure out where we're going with this story in this first book.
Let's bring this up. Pam, what's the difference between, say, time travel and parallel universes?
I mean, what's the similarity?
Ooh.
Ooh. Ooh. Yeah, got it. She's a teacher. She's prepared for us.
Wow.
I guess I'm just thinking that, I mean, time is, in my mind at least, a totally different dimension than dimension, right? So parallel universes, I mean, it's, you're moving between different places. Where,
realities.
Yeah. But it's back to that idea of the do-over. That's where we have been for the last two books, that we have the opportunity to travel to a different place instead of a different time. And in that different place, we have the opportunity to see those people that we lost. And that's what we get in book two here, is Annie is somebody who's very important to Rassel. And
but that's not a do-over,
isn't it?
Where one person died, and all right, you know, we go to a stoplight. One person goes left, one person goes right. The person who goes left died. The person who right lives. That was just in that reality. That person didn't pass away. I mean, there's similarities, I would say, in the sense that there's an infinite possibility of an infinite number of choices, of an infinite number of beings who can make choices.
I mean, do you think it comes down to the model of reality that you look at? So like, because some time travel, you don't actually, like, for example, Time Traveler's Wife, I don't think you have parallel universes in that story. You simply have the one universe, one timeline, and you could just move to different spaces on it. Whereas with something like recursion, you're creating new timelines, which function in a sense as alternate dimensions or universes. And so it kind of depends on your model of time, whether
because
even moderately related or not, because you could definitely have time travel if the world is fixed with absolutely no parallel universes, but you could have both. And we did in recursion.
And in this one, at one point, he does say, it's still daylight. I must have gained a couple of hours. So he is moving both through space and, well, not space. He is moving both through dimensions. And time.
Sure.
So that's,
but he wouldn't have to be, right? Like, you could imagine a multidimensional world without time travel, and you can imagine a time travel world without multiple dimensions.
Wow.
Many possibilities for the science fiction.
Let's just say that Saturday mornings are time to, you know, expand the mind.
You mean after Tom and Jerry or
for our listeners, Tom and Jerry the movie was just released on HBO Max this morning. So
was it? Do we? Okay, we're not going to get into that. This is not the pop culture show that it used to be. But really? There's a Tom and Jerry movie? What an alternate reality this is.
All right, so let's talk a little bit more about the Native American imagery that we get introduced to. We get the man in the maze. It's a picture, if you can think of it as a man or a person at the outside of it. There is a circle, and basically there's a labyrinth that kind of moves its way towards the center of the circle. And then there's it has a symbolic place in it, and it is sort of a Native American imagery.
Right. It is from a Native American tribe, and it has seven concentric circles with the seed pattern in the center. It symbolizes that life, that idea of the labyrinth of life, the maze that is life. You start at one spot and ultimately wind up back at the same spot again. Interesting.
Well, you're going towards the center. eventually you'll hit death. Mm-hmm. And there are times when, as you move towards the center, that the twists and turns become faster.
Hmm. Very interesting symbolism here that we are utilizing for the idea of the maze of life. Those situations that we need to make a choice, left or right, just like a maze. I'm reminded, of course, of the Theater of the Absurd from the 1950s. Are you guys familiar with the Theater of the Absurd?
Tell us more about it, Steve.
This is a style of theater, a style of playwriting that demonstrates the absurd futility of human existence. Life is an unsolvable maze, and trying to figure it out is completely futile. The most elegant version of this is Waiting for Godot. Are you familiar with Waiting for Godot?
Tell us more about this, Dave.
Okay, so there's this play called Waiting for Godot, where these two characters are on stage and having conversations that seem much more figurative than they are actual narrative. There's no beginning, there's no end, there's no story, there's no characterizations. There are unexplained themes, there's an imitation of, it's kind of like a dream or a nightmare, and it uses useless dialogue to demonstrate this theater of the absurd idea that everything is just futile. The two characters say they're waiting for Godot. There is no character in this play named Godot. Godot never shows up. They are just on stage, the two of them, explaining nothing for 2 hours.
So I, as I'm listening to that, and while it's fascinating, it doesn't really resonate with something that would be passed on from generation to generation. It seems very modern, because mm-hmm. when you're dealing with Native American imagery, or Greek, or Egyptian, or Norse, or any type of mythology you could kind of throw up, or you know, even the Judeo-Christian path where there's lots of symbolism.
Mm-hmm.
The symbolism is to pass generations and generations and generations. And I'm much more likely to think of the work of, say, Joseph Campbell,
mm-hmm.
where he is much more, I mean, his work was basically reading into how the myths, while, you know, we're in India, they may tell this story one way. In, say, the Middle East, they may tell it a different way. In Greece, they may have presented it a different way. But they are all basically telling a similar story. Similar
the
enough.
Hero's story. Journey, yes.
But, I mean, I just pulled one. It says, life has no meaning. Each of us has a meaning, and we bring it to life. It's a waste to be asking the question when you are the answer. Basically, this idea that if you're looking at the labyrinth of life and you are the person on the outside knowing this maze, you're the answer to getting to the center of that. Wow. It's your journey. And not to get too, you know, esoteric on it, but this idea that that we bring up this modern way of looking at it, it would not have resonated to those generations in the past. They may not have understood it. And that's the reason why, if you can go to Sam, you know, Aborigines or something like that, and they draw like the picture that they've drawn for 5,000 years, one generation can understand the story versus another. Anyway, I'm just kind of, we're kind of taking it in a very esoteric way.
Really? This idea of existence? Huh.
Waiting for Godot is such an interesting play to teach. I must admit, I usually teach Endgame when it comes to Beckett. I just like the chess metaphor of it. But either way, either of those plays, they come to the same thing. So Beckett attempts, and he tries really, really hard, to create a situation that has no meaning, right? So you're giving him more credit than I, and reading it quite differently than I am, Steve, in terms of, you talk about how it contains like useless dialogue. But when I teach either one of these plays, and any of the absurdists really, I feel like part of what happens is that you get this sense We cannot get away from meaning. So language, linguistic systems are totally filled with arbitrary signs, of course, but at the same time, even these arbitrary signs are not without meaning. And so when you put humans in relationship with one another, it's actually impossible, I think, and Beckett does like the best job of anyone, to get outside of systems of meaning. And I think that in fact, that is one of the themes of this text. And it is encapsulated in that notion of the maze of life, that there always are meanings, even in a very postmodern world in which we try to imagine what it would be not to have meaning. The very act of imagining is a meaning-making activity. And so I don't know. I think whenever I teach the absurdists, that's the conclusion that students often come to is, wow, this is a great attempt to step outside of meaning, but you can't really do it. And in some ways, time travel, like querying various things that we think we understand, like time, like space, like dimension, like universe, you can always think outside of them. And the very act of doing that always gives more meaning to the moment that you're in instead of less.
Mm-hmm. That's why the absurdists are so much fun to study, because by destroying the narrative and making a totally different shape, you are automatically going to compare that to the shape of all of the other narrative, and you go, ha ha, there's shape to this thing that you're supposed to be no shape to. Ha ha.
And I think that with the maze of life, we see it in two very different forms. We see the symbol on a necklace, right? So a symbolic representation. And then we actually see him go to the university museum where it looks like you might even be able to do a physical maze. And that notion of doing a physical maze, of being inside the maze, of being the rat, as we all are in our lives, being the cog, versus seeing the maze, seeing the other cogs. I mean, that's the pleasure of literature, right? Is between the space of the seer and the beer.
Oh, that's interesting. Because you're right. Knowing the theory doesn't mean you've experienced it.
But literature is a way that we build the empathy, having experienced something that we never will. And speculative fiction,
sure,
like this, whether we're traveling through time or dimension or whatever, is still a way to access these experiences that we'll never have, but that we can nonetheless understand as humans who share language, regardless of how arbitrary its symbols are.
Tom and Jerry.
All right.
Rick and Morty.
That's right. Rick and Morty. There we go. We got infinite universes. All right. So one of the things that we need to note here is that we do get a flashback where we learn that there was a scientist. There's a male scientist, there's a female scientist, and there is our hero. They're getting ready to get their funding for their research. As the scientist pops the champagne and is celebrating that, what do we learn? We learn our hero and the other female scientist there are having an affair. Mm-hmm.
And that's Maya.
And that is where we get another insight that, not all is not, we're not living in this wonder bread of a world. We certainly there's a very, there's a reality there. There's a lot more going on than just, the science of what we're dealing with.
And then we get to part three, which is called Maya, wherein our hero gets to another alternative universe of some sort and finds a person who looks just like Maya, but it's not Maya, it's Uma.
I was about to ask, are we going to skip over the adult portion? Because I feel like when you have a young man like our Rassel, whether he's very young or not, we can't quite tell. When he leaves the bed of a prostitute to go to a strip club, right? A prostitute who's given him some credit here, mind you. What does that tell you about this character? And how does that represent the erotic? I mean, in one of the scenes, he's really focused on self-medication through alcohol. in this book too, is he self-medicating through sex? And what does that suggest? Like, what are the various options? We've got sex, drugs.
And rock and roll.
And meditation, right? All of these different ways to get a little bit outside of one's rational perspective.
All right, so on some level, you know, this is alternate realities. But at the same time, he's escaping reality, whatever reality he's in, isn't he? So, I mean, there's
escaping the rational, I would say.
Okay. Right?
Escaping the rational perspective. These are the tools that we have at our disposal to escape the rational.
And his previous life, he was totally working within the rational, right? He's a scientist, and he's trying to do this. And there's some disillusion from how he's looking at reality, his reality, his life. He's very reckless compared to where he was. If he wasn't, I'm sorry, it's really hard to say that. I mean, he was certainly acting reckless in the scientist's office. Anyway, there's a lot going on here.
There's a lot going on in these first three books, for sure. We see him go to an alternate reality where he tries to find Annie, because we see Annie has been murdered by the simian-looking, alien-looking antagonist in the second book. And in the third book, he goes to a different reality where Annie hasn't been murdered, and he gets there just in time as the simian-looking, alien-looking antagonist is arriving, and he goes and stops him from murdering her again.
Right. So, but we also eventually learn, and I don't know where we learned it, that Rassel and this antagonist, they're the only versions of themselves.
Hmm. That he's never met another version of himself in all of his leaping through all of these alternative universes. That's very interesting.
Okay. And my point being is that they are their own beings, but you know, there's not another version of them, and so they're slipping through these alternate universes. That tells me they're unique.
And the simian antagonist has his own rocket engines that he uses in the same way that Rassel does, but his helmet is certainly different. It's not that ancient looking Aztec calendar. It's a very modern plastic or glass helmet.
And then I'm curious what you think of the idea that he's an art thief, that he's stealing a Picasso, so a cubist. And then when that Picasso gets shot and there's this bullet hole in the foot of this personage depicted in the Picasso painting, how do we read that? It seems like a very evocative moment to see that Picasso with the bullet hole, but I'm not quite sure how to read it. What do you guys think?
Well, I'm thinking Picasso is a shorthand for artist. And I'm not sure if you would have picked another artist, may not have been as recognized as Picasso as a name. That's my initial thought. You're trying to work with your reader on that.
Who specifically is putting things together in an unusual way.
Well, you know, you're right. He works in surrealism, and certainly this idea of a unique version of reality. So yeah, maybe I'm not thinking of it as deep as that as you did there. Good point. And obviously, the bullet hole makes it useless.
Or does it? Because here's the thing, though. If you're moving from reality to reality, what's the meaning, right? What's, like, how do you construct meaning if you can, like, mess up in one world and then just move to another one, right? And so, in some sense, like, art, aesthetics, that's what like holds you together.
Very
good. You can get a bullet hole in your art by moving between universes. I don't know.
Wow.
But the power of art here, I think it is relevant that what they're moving between universes isn't some sort of, I shouldn't say, I was about to say economic commodity, but It's
well, you could have. I mean, could he have taken gold? Would gold?
Well, that's what I'm saying. He's not moving minerals. He's moving art.
Hmm.
I think that's important. Let's just keep it. I have no idea how to read it, but let's just keep it in mind. I think it's possibly relevant, and it gets damaged. But you guys know, like, that kind of damage, I don't think that this is a useless piece of art. I feel like this is a piece of art from another dimension that was shot in this fantastic story.
But he also gave it to the prostitute, and the prostitute, didn't she say, what can I do with this? I can't sell it. Basically, it can sit in a closet.
Right.
But I'm not sure that she has, like an art curator's view for the fact that sometimes stories give special economic value to a piece of art as well.
Okay.
Who knows? I don't know. Maybe this never comes back. It just struck me that, like, when she said, oh, this is worthless, I was like, I'm not so sure, because that's a piece of art from another dimension.
How do you prove that, though?
Bullet hole.
Bullet hole. Because there's no nothing. Bullets in this
that
dimension.
There's nothing. You're right.
There are two more ideas that are not tied up in this first act that we will have to keep our eye on going forward. The first one is Maxwell's equations. Are you guys familiar with Maxwell's equations as they're presented here?
Tell us
I am
about
not.
It.
Okay, so Maxwell, in 1861, of course it's Victorian, Pam. Maxwell came up with these four elegant equations that perfectly describe electricity and magnetism, uniting them as a single force. And these equations have held up through all of our work with science and magnetism and electricity ever since. And the quote in the book is, Maxwell described the world as knowable, that we can quantify things that are invisible, like magnetism. And we can, therefore, utilize this idea because it is knowable.
And that seems very much in line with the Tesla quote earlier on. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's the theme of this story, that the universe, as esoteric as it is, as surreal as it could get, is knowable.
Mm-hmm. I think that is definitely the theme of this first part.
Knowable through multiple lenses, right? Not only through the lens of science. We have also meditation. We have aesthetics. And we have these various methods of getting outside of the rational, like sex, drugs, rock and roll, and meditation.
And Bob Dylan.
Let's just basically say the wine is just starting to work at this point. I'm in a good spot.
There's one more symbol that will get you even farther, Chip. That is this symbol that we see throughout this story of the pebble being dropped into the water and the ripples that it creates. All of that metaphor of creating ripples and changing things is throughout this narrative.
The idea of putting any element, any change, all of a sudden you get the vibrations, the ripples, the changes that happen. That's any time a decision is made, any time an external force makes its presence known, it changes everything.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, this man!
This is the deepest book you've ever brought to the book club, Chip.
Got it. And I brought the comic, right? That's the whole point.
Here's a funny book for you to read. Oh, wait. It's full of all sorts of philosophical thought. Thanks, Chip.
I just want to make sure our listeners know. This book, you read it so quickly. We read three chapters, and I was wondering if it was enough to have a discussion. But, I mean,
And here we are an hour later.
It just flies. I mean, you go through the material so quickly.
But there's so much to it. If you take the time to look for all of the things that Jeff Smith has given us to think about, we get quite a philosophical conversation out of this. So I hope everybody else is getting that same conversation. I hope we have enough. Chip, do we have enough information to survive another week?
Only if we can come back next week, Steve.
He's holding his face, ladies and gentlemen. He's not sure if we have enough information because he thought we had no information, and now he's on information overload, ladies and gentlemen. We've broken Chip. What do you think, Pam?
I've been on information overload all week, so I suspect this will continue on another week.
So what is our assignment for next week, Chip?
We're going to do 4 through 7. It's called The Fire of St. George, and hopefully we'll have another wonderful discussion just like we're having right now.
I think we will, because the symbolism of the fire of St. George is great symbolism, if you know the story of St. George. We'll get to that next week. I hope you are reading along with us. We hope you're enjoying our philosophical hour-long discussion of this funny book while we've been discussing it. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4867. Our website is sandwichesatirregularhours.com. Our email is sandwichesatirregularhours@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and YouTube. I want to thank you again for listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflug.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
We'll see you in the next dimension.